The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This week, we're going to be looking at the actual origin stories of the monsters. There's an excellent new podcast done by David Sirota and the team at The Lever called Master Plan. And it is an essential history of the plutocratic threat to American democracy and how it became so powerful. And I want to just like jump right into it because it's a great podcast. I'm going to encourage everyone to listen to it, but I want to like get at some of the thinking behind it and some of the arguments. So I'm very happy to have David Sirota, the host and I guess main voice on the podcast. But I should mention it's actually done by a team. He has a great website called The Lever, which like pay for. And it is like a great website in the sense of it actually does investigative news. It breaks stories all the time. It's nonpartisan. It goes after Democrats when they have to, as well as Republicans. And it's an essential source for the news. And this is an era where a lot of people pay for substacks that offer opinion. And that's not what these guys are doing. They're doing the actual reporting that we need, which is also true of this podcast, as we'll get into. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's just give listeners, what is this podcast about? And just what's the main argument here?
So the main argument is that that we live in a world of obvious, pervasive corruption, where money is essentially determinative of political outcomes, almost all political outcomes, and that this was not a force of nature. It was not an inevitability, that the moneyed politics that we live in today is a creation of a specific set of people with a specific set of goals. One of their goals to achieve all the other goals was to deregulate the campaign finance system and gut the anti-bribery, anti-corruption laws, and that they implemented this plan over about five decades. And the point is that if you understand that it was an artificial set of decisions, not a natural inevitability, if you understand that, you can understand that we could make different choices to have a better system. So, and I'll add one other point, and we can get into any of this stuff, which is that basically this plan started because the government of the United States was perceived to be too democratically responsive to the public. That this plan, the modern iteration of it, really came together at a moment when the U.S. government was doing all sorts of things to respond to the grievances of the population in the early 70s. I mean, if you're looking out at what was going on in the early 70s and you're an oligarch or a corporation, you're looking at a government that just did, in a span of a couple of years, Medicare, Medicaid, civil rights laws, the voting rights laws, created the EPA, created the Clean Air Act, created the Clean Water Act, declared a war on poverty. I mean, that all happened in basically less than 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so the corporate class, when this plan was hatched, was really freaked out that the democracy was working too responsively to the public.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Like the show, starts at the 60s and early 70s. I mean, if you want to take a sort of broader picture, the historian Arthur Schlesinger used to talk about the sort of cycles of American history. You know, like America's obviously had periods of like, incredible oligarchic reaction. You know, one thinks of the Gilded Age as a classic example. But, Schlesinger talked about how there would be then, movements of reform that would come up, like the progressives, the New Deal. And then, the 60s is a classic kind of example of that. And, the idea of cycles, not all historians kind of accept this, but there's a kind of broad common sense way in which that kind of makes sense, that you're constantly seeing a struggle between disparate forces of, mobilized on the one hand for, making America, sharing the wealth, making it a more equal land, and people who like don't want that because they actually own they're the ones that control the wealth. And so you're starting the late 60s, early 70s, like incredible cultural ferment that I think we're still benefiting from now, like in terms of, civil rights, gay rights, feminism, but consumer protection. And then, like the people, the powers that be, as you say, we're not delighted. quite interestingly focuses on something called the Powell Memo. So do you want to like just describe what that is?
Yeah. So Lewis Powell in the 60s and into the early 70s was kind of like the pinnacle of the establishment. He was the head of the American Bar Association. He was a major corporate lawyer. He was on the board of Philip Morris. He was considered a well-respected legal voice, right? American Bar Association is supposed to represent sort of the whole legal community. So top of the establishment and is known among those who know him as is sort of has a persona, a reputation as a moderate. But
yeah, I just want to underscore that point because I think this is one of the key areas where your podcast is very revisionist and really overturns like conventional wisdom. Because yeah, after listening to the podcast, I went back and read the New York Times obituary and right. The whole, you know, from the opening sentence to the end, it's all about this was a great moderate. This was the guy who was like in an age where the Supreme Court is becoming more partisan, you know, was just like balls and strikes. He's the perfect umpire. You could never know where he's going to stand. You know, he voted with the liberals, you know, and it's worth noting it's factual. Like he was one of the justices on Roe v. Wade.
Right.
On affirmative action, he like played a very important role in protecting that. So reading from the New York Times, and that's like overwhelming. The NPR New York Times worldview is this guy is the perfect centrist justice. And I think that the listeners to your podcast will find a lot of evidence for something very different.
Right. So while he's cutting this sort of public profile as a moderate in the late 60s into the early 70s, he's also starting to give speeches that are quite reactionary. Against the social movements of the 60s. In the podcast, you can hear audio of some of these speeches where he's sounding more like Ronald Reagan, right? You know, he's upset. Specifically, he's upset with the social unrest. He seems to be really rattled by the social unrest of the era, sort of becomes kind of a law and order kind of guy. And you know, this is the era of, you know, youngish Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater, and the like. Into the early 70s, he sees his nemesis, his sort of ideological nemesis, Ralph Nader, becoming one of the most respected and famous people in the whole country. I think a lot of people forget this, but Ralph Nader in the late 1960s into the early 90s has a very wide name ID, very, very famous, and is considered in polls. Polls say people say he's one of the most respected people in the whole country because of all the
influential, hugely influential,
hugely influential. Right. Yeah. And it's because he's publishing books that are exposing corporate malfeasance. His work is being turned into legislation. He has a whole legal apparatus that's filing public interest lawsuits and getting the courts to rule on those lawsuits. Ralph Nader gets written up in Fortune magazine in the early 1970s, and this basically drives Lewis Powell to write a manifesto. He calls up his friend at the Chamber of Commerce. This is in 1971, and he basically writes a manifesto for what business needs to do to prevent the government from becoming even more democratically responsive, and what business can do to kind of appropriate the tactics of Ralph Nader for its own political ends. And the memo lays out different areas that he believes corporate forces need to essentially infiltrate in order to exert their political will and get what they want. And one of the big focuses of the memo is taking over the judicial system. And not only taking over the judicial system, but also, again, filing lawsuits that will prompt the courts to issue certain rulings that business wants. Now, this is where the story, there's been some question of, you know, well, was this just a glorified Reddit thread or a glorified Facebook post of the 1970s? You know, he writes it down, nobody cares, that's it, it's over.
Yeah, I should mention there are people, you know, who have looked at the Powell memo and have said that. I'll just name check a very smart policy analyst, Mark Schmidt, writing in the American Prospect, who said, well, people are overstating the importance of the Powell memo. We know he wrote it, but, you know, like, how many people actually read it. And this is where I actually think, you know, your podcast is a rare case of something like, you know, really changing my mind on a big historical question. Because I Schmidt's articles seemed very plausible to me, and that's my understanding of things. And then, like, you guys, you actually found the smoking guns.
We found
the evidence that actually shows what the actual real world impact of this was. So this is like, let's lay this down. This was not just some like disgruntled lawyer, you know, like writing about, you know, like I'm pissed off at Ralph Nader. This is actually something that resonated and had like a huge ripple effect.
Yes. So, and I want to preface this by saying, look, I think there's still a debate over whether the Powell memo crystallized and catalyzed a corporate and oligarch discontent of the era versus the Powell memo created the discontent. I think there's, you know, it's sort of that.
This is a classic historical debate. You know, is this a history making man or is it an eventful man that came at the right moment? And I'll mention, like, if you want to, you know, do the broader history, which I think your podcast is a great example of good public history. So to, you know, like, I think in the late 60s, early 70s, you saw a lot of different versions of the Powell memo because the elites were very unhappy.
Samuel
Huntington, a hugely influential political scientist at Harvard, you know, wrote this report for the Trilateral Commission saying there's a crisis of democracy. And by crisis of democracy, he meant America's becoming too democratic. There's too many people who are like getting a voice in the system, and we got to cut back on that. Murray Rothbard, the libertarian economist, wrote a big memo for the Koch brothers saying again the same thing, you know, like America's getting derailed, you know, like we need a plan to take it back. So a lot of people are thinking along this line, and the Powell memo is one manifestation of what I think is a widespread elite freakout, that the people who are used to being deferred to, they're used to like setting the rules of society, they're suddenly seeing there's all these other forces, you know, women, African Americans, Latinos, gay people, anti-war people, anti-corporate people that are suddenly asking for a seat at the table. And so, you know, Powell memo is like a manifestation of its time. But it's also something that actually, because so many people shared its concern, it actually resonated. And a lot of people joined the bandwagon and saw this as a plan.
I would also say the because it was written by Lewis Powell.
Yeah.
It really added powerful, and not just written by Lewis Powell, but written by Lewis Powell for the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, yeah.
It came with a kind of credibility. Mm-hmm. And ultimately a kind of distribution that any of the other sort of lesser manifestos of the era carried. You know, it's one thing for, you know, a couple of random business people to say this stuff. It's another thing for the head of the American Bar Association to write a 30-page, you know, detailed blueprint for how to take the government back and write it for the Chamber of Commerce. And what comes out of it, to be, you know, concrete about it, is a series of there's a Powell memo task force that's created by the Chamber of Commerce, that's populated by top executives at some of the most powerful corporations in America, Phillips Petroleum, ABC, CBS. I mean, you know, there's and they have a series of secret meetings to go over how they can best implement the Powell memo and what they are doing to implement the recommendations of the Powell memo. Now, we go over, you know, we found this record of this incredibly detailed slideshow that U.S. Steel lobbyist William White, very close associate of President Gerald Ford, the slideshow of him going over what is being done, implement the Powell memo. He was the chair of the Powell memo task force. And there's everything from lobbying on campaign finance issues to the production of a movie starring Jimmy Stewart to a PR campaign, an ad campaign through the Ad Council to promote the American economic system, quote unquote, in the face of a rising push for social democracy. A whole ton of stuff that comes out of the Powell memo. But for purposes of the Master Plan podcast, which is about deregulating campaign finance and legalizing corruption, one thing that comes out of the Powell memo task force is a focus on the campaign finance laws that were emerging out of the Watergate era in response to the Watergate era. There's, as an example, there's a meeting in Disney World where Gerald Ford is flown into Disney World. He's the House Minority Leader. He's a couple months away from becoming vice president and then soon after that president. And they're focused on the Federal Election Campaign Act, which had passed actually before Watergate. But there was a push at this time in the middle of the Watergate scandal to strengthen those laws with the much better known 1974 Federal Election Campaign Act amendments, which really did create the modern campaign finance system. And one of the things that comes out of this meeting is a focus on adding amendments to the final bill that would allow for the creation and explosion of corporate political action committees, which, you know, in a perfect sort of poetic justice, a sort of circular perfection, is that Gerald Ford ends up signing the new law, the bill into law, with those loopholes. So he was at the meeting. He ends up being the guy who signs the law with the loopholes that allow for the explosion of corporate PACs. And what then comes after that, remember I said Lewis Powell's memo focuses on the legal system. The legal groups that – and the nascent conservative legal movement that comes out of the Powell memo and all that organizing, one of its first cases is a case right after those amendments pass to try to invalidate the entire law by having the Supreme Court enshrine a then radical theory that money in politics is not corruption. Money in politics is constitutionally protected speech. This is the famous Buckley v. Valeo case. And that's a case, by the way, masterminded by none other than John Bolton, the same John Bolton. As we say in the podcast, there's kind of a master plan cinematic universe here of people who keep popping up. John Bolton's one of them. Robert Bork is another one. And they get the Supreme Court.
Well, the American political elite, you would think, like, it's a country of 350 million people. You have a large number of people. It's actually like it's about like 20 guys who are always going to the same parties.
It really is.
And I'll say Bolton, you know, like we know him as evil because he wants regime changes all over the world. But one of the places he wants regime changes in the United States.
Absolutely. And this was sort of part of that. And they get Buckley v. Valeo. Money is speech. Mm-hmm. And I should have mentioned, after the Powell memo was written, 3 months after the Powell memo was written, Lewis Powell is nominated to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon. Interesting side note, the Powell memo at that point was circulating, but it wasn't like publicly, it was circulating among the business elite. It was certainly circulating among the Chamber of Commerce and its members, but it wasn't widely known, but it was certainly, you know, it was certainly out there. And when Powell gets nominated to the Supreme Court, curiously, the FBI does not include it in its report to the senators, to the U.S. Senate that reviews judicial nominations. And this is a Democratic Senate that had rejected both of Richard Nixon's prior nominees. So in theory, had the FBI included this memo, it might have generated a lot of opposition to Powell's nomination, but it was omitted. And by the way, it was omitted. And now we have documents showing that Lewis Powell was in correspondence and pretty close touch with J. Edgar Hoover and J. Edgar Hoover's deputy as a source to help the FBI root out supposed communists in the legal profession. So you put one and one together, right? Like, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI did not include the Powell memo in the report to the Senate. Powell unanimously sails through to the Supreme Court. And where does this come into play? Where does this ultimately become really salient? After the Buckley v. Valeo case enshrines money as speech, Lewis Powell, very soon after that, works behind the scenes at the Supreme Court to take a subsequent campaign finance case and broaden it out into a case he writes the ruling that basically says corporations are entitled to those same money is speech constitutional protections when corporations want to spend in the election.
Yeah, no, this is, clearly Powell was pursuing an agenda. I just want to like go back to that, what you were just saying about Nixon putting him on the Supreme Court, because I don't know if there's any evidence of this. So it's pure speculation on my part, maybe. But like, could the Powell memo itself have been influential in getting Powell on the courts. Because what I'm thinking here is Nixon had tried to put in two conservative justices and they were shot down. He needed someone who could be seen as a moderate, but he, you know, wanted someone who's like actually not a moderate. And there's this memo that indicates that, hey, this Lewis Powell guy who has eminently respectable credentials, but he's actually really one of us. Is it possible that Nixon or the people who are advising Nixon were aware of the Powell memo?
Two things. One, I can tell you that people close to the Nixon Ford administration were connected to the Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
Baroody is one of them.
Yeah.
So do I have evidence that the Nixon White House read the Powell memo? No, I don't have evidence of that. But there's also a call between Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan in which Richard Nixon refers to Powell as a corporation lawyer and that this is his pick. The conversation is essentially Nixon saying, this is my sort of corporate pick. I need to I need to make this, because here's what's really interesting at the time is that Powell was picked in tandem with Bill Rehnquist, who was also nominated. There were two seats open. Interestingly enough, two seats open because of a corruption scandal. The Abe Fortas corruption scandal. Abe Fortas was an LBJ Supreme Court appointee who decided to resign amid a scandal over him taking a $20,000 payment to write some papers for a major financier. That was a big scandal at the time. It sounds quaint compared to what's going on at the Supreme Court today.
Yeah.
But so Nixon has two picks. He picks first, he tries two previous guys who were essentially, if not segregationists.
Very anti-civil rights.
Right. Anti-civil rights. They get shot down by the Democratic Senate. So his next two are Rehnquist and Powell. And Rehnquist is seen as the firebrand pick. Rehnquist is seen as the really controversial pick because Rehnquist is kind of a political ideologue, sort of very public political ideologue. And Powell is seen, even, you know, obviously by Nixon, as a business, as a business pick. And Powell sails through almost unanimously because he's seen as moderate. But I'll just, that's a long way of saying, I think between the connections of the Chamber of Commerce and the Nixon Ford administration, and Nixon referring to Powell in shorthand as his corporation lawyer pick, it was known to be, this is my pick for business.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. And I want to just say something. This is like a sort of problem with the way that liberals, perhaps more in the past than now, but liberals in the 70s and 80s and 90s looked at the courts, which is that they were really concerned about what we would call social issues, rightly so, like, you know, abortion, affirmative action. And if you were like, sided with the liberals on that, you were seen as a moderate, but not really that concerned about these sort of, you know, economic cases, which are the vast majority of cases that go before the courts are really dealing with, like, you know, things that affect economic policy or the economic environment. And so a lot of these, like, business corporate justices were able to get away with a lot because liberals, Democrats just winked at that. Maybe they were even happy with it to get like a corporate lawyer in there. So this is like there's a Republican component to this, but there's also a Democratic Party component of being a little bit too comfortable with corporate plutocracy.
Absolutely. And the thing is that the Supreme Court is mostly dealing with business cases.
Yeah.
So there is this understanding, I think, a better understanding on the right and certainly among sort of big business that while the social issues, and not to say that they're not important, but while the social issues get a lot of the headlines out of the Supreme Court is mostly a place to arbitrate business issues.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
The
contracts.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The right was attuned to that for a very long time. And I do not think the left was really attuned to that at all. And I think part of that is that, you know, especially in the modern sense, the Democratic Party has been not as much of a business party as the Republicans have been, but certainly not a party hostile to corporate power in any ways.
No, the Democrats have their own big law component, and that's always been friendly towards corporate America. But I mean, like, to underscore something, though, Powell, I mean, it's not just enough to say he's a corporate lawyer, because I mean, the details that you found are quite incredible. Like, so when he's elevated to the Supreme Court, you know, Philip Morris, the you know, his longtime client, they throw a party for him, hire Walter Cronkite to host the event, and they give him a judicial robe with their logo on it, which I think is the perfect symbol of how the courts are owned by the corporations.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, you can't even make this up. I mean, there's this whole, you know, there's this idea politicians should, like, you know, wear corporate logos on their suits to, like, NASCAR drivers to let us know who they represent. And there was this, you know, there was this urban legend that there was this big gala thrown for Lewis Powell by Philip Morris, again, on whose board he served, a gala thrown for him as a send-off party for after he got confirmed. And it was sort of an urban legend that this thing actually happened. And we ultimately actually found a vinyl record recording of the event. And the event was emceed by Walter Cronkite, who was at the time, the CBS News anchor. He emceed the party and did a sort of send-up of his show. At the time was called You Are There. It's sort of a every week you do a biography of some, you know, somebody in history, You Are There. And they did a send-up of Lewis Powell's life at this event, at this gala. And then the gala sort of crescendos with the head of Philip Morris presenting Lewis Powell with a justice's robe where the brand logos of the of Morris's cigarette brands are emblazoned on the robe. And we know this not just from the recording, but the vinyl record had a cover on it with pictures of all of this. I mean, you can't even make this stuff up. As I said before, I feel like I sound, when I tell that part of the story, I sound like Donald Sutherland on the park bench in JFK. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't sound believable. It's all documented. You can hear it in the podcast. We put needle to vinyl record. You can actually hear it. And on our website at levernews.com, you can actually see the cover of the record.
Well, yeah, the Philip Morris thing, I think I also want to underscore the importance of that, because it's not just, okay, you know, this guy's a lawyer, Philip Morris is his client, you know, you're a lawyer, you always have unsavory clients of different sorts. No, this is something a little bit different. He's more like, you know, the lawyer for the Godfather. Like he's like, you know, the guy who's like in the room when they're planning out their war strategy. And in the case of Philip Morris, it's the fact that, you know, science discovered cigarettes cause cancer, and they were like in a denial mode and created a strategy of creating these astroturf groups that would lie using the courts to like delay. You know, the same strategy that I think underscores not just the fight on climate, it was copied by the fossil fuel companies, but really this whole era of the master plan, as you call it. Like I think that, in addition to the Powell memo, is really the importance of Lewis Powell. Like this strategy of how corporations could use the available tools within American democracy and really game the system and go beyond the norms. He's a pioneer. He's absolutely the pioneer of this.
Yeah, and I think it's important. You're right. You know, being on the board of any old company is different than being on the board and being a legal advisor to the tobacco industry, especially at this particular time.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is the time in which the Ralph Naders of the world and others like him are raising for the first time in a really amplified way all the questions about smoking and public health. And you're right to liken it to climate, where the tobacco industry is trying to say everything's fine, push off government regulation, et cetera, et cetera. And Lewis Powell is intimately involved in that. So the point being,
well, people died because of this. This strategy led to, you know, like the struggle to get down cigarette smoking taking much longer than it had to take. So this is just to underscore, like, you know, like this guy, this whole image at the New York Times was presenting to its readers that this is the great moderate. That's not who Lewis Powell was at all.
No, that's not who Lewis Powell was at all, especially when it came to corporate power. I mean, I look at Lewis Powell and I think he was moderate on the things that corporate power didn't really care about, which is basically what a corrupt political system has created, right? I mean, if you think about what is at the center of our politics, generally, you really zoom out a little bit here, right? I mean, it's sort of the two parties have sort of, in a sense, there's sort of a Venn diagram of here's what the public wants on one side. Here's what the donors want and or at least can accept. And then let's overlap those things. And it's typically a very relatively small subset of issues that our politics then rhetorically becomes about. So there's a lot of talk in our politics, and not to say these issues aren't important, but like a lot of talk about identity politics, a lot of talk about reproductive rights, a lot of talk about so-called social issues, in part because those are the issues that the public wants action on, certainly, but also they don't offend or challenge or limit corporate power. And so it's this Lewis Powell is that in microcosm, right?
Yeah.
He is, you know, he votes with the liberals on Roe v. Wade. He votes the liberals on affirmative action issues that sort of corporate power doesn't really threaten corporate power. But then when it comes to like, do corporations have a First Amendment unlimited right to spend in elections? Lewis Powell is authoring that opinion and organizing support for that opinion behind the scenes in a very aggressive way at the Supreme Court, right? That's what we now call moderate. Moderate is sort of a blanket term for is moderate on social issues, but also doesn't challenge corporate power at all and serves the donor class. That's what moderate has come to be defined as in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know, and that profile that you pointed out of, you know, Powell as a sort of the corporate moderate, actually explains also the importance of the Powell memo and how it crystallized things. Because, like, going back to the New Deal era and World War II, there was a divide on the business community between the sort of corporate right, which is very internationalist, and the sort of, you know, Midwestern small town business side, which was like a very isolationist, very suspicious of like foreign intervention, and a much more radically against the system, and more radically against the New Deal, was not willing to make compromises with the New Deal. But like with the Powell memo, he basically created a formula where the Philip Morris, you know, country club Republicans could unite with the more libertarian, right, populist John Bircher, Koch brother conservatives on these issues. And so creating a, you know, a very powerful coalition that, you know, has effectively rolled back many of the achievements of the 60s. So if we see him in that term, that actually explains who he was and his huge importance in American history.
Yeah, absolutely. The merging of the libertarian John Bircher Goldwater strain of conservatism with the big business corporation, Fortune 500 company, tree club Republican strain of conservatism. Powell's memo, in a sense, can be seen as a kind of umbrella that they can all have a piece of. And it kind of brings them together. And now I, you know, politically, this obviously culminates in Ronald Reagan in 1980, right? I mean, that's really where it politically culminates. And it's worth mentioning, you know, to bring it up to date to, you know, people hear about Project 2025. Out of the Powell memo, one of the people who's inspired by the Powell memo is Joseph Kors, who, I mean, and that's documented. He said he was stirred by the Powell memo to go from being just a beer brewer to being involved politically. And the thing that he decides to seed fund is the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation decides in all this, you know, there's legal organizing, there's, you know, political organizing. The Heritage Foundation carves out its role in this as a kind of, as the policy driver, launches its so-called Mandate for Leadership series, which is a blueprint for Republican conservative presidents to just take it off the shelf, start implementing things. Ronald Reagan gets elected and uses the first Mandate for Leadership manifesto as a policy guidepost for his administration, puts a lot of those things into law through executive action, through legislation. It's worth mentioning Project 2025 is called Project 2025, but Project 2025 is the ninth iteration of the Mandate for Leadership series. That's actually what Project 2025 is. So the point being, you can draw a very direct line from the Powell memo to Project 2025 today, and how effective this Powell memo movement is in doing what it set out to do. And of course, again, it's worth mentioning, in our podcast series, so much of what makes the implementation possible is them keeping the eye on deregulating the campaign finance system. Mm-hmm. Because deregulating the campaign finance system lets them buy more elections, which lets them buy more legislation, which lets them buy more court appointments, right? Getting rid of the anti-bribery laws, getting rid of campaign donation limits, unlimited spending, super PACs, all of that is the foundation for the political success of this.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you brought it up to date with that, because I think that that's a good note to end on. And I want to underscore something. In the sort of presidential debate that we just saw, Kamala Harris quite properly, mentioned that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. And I think that's something we can all agree on. But I think that in a lot of ways, this sort of Democratic rhetoric that one sees from the Democratic Party, it seems both correct, but a little bit superficial in the sense that it's all just Trump. You know, we have this one bad actor, Trump, and he's the threat. And there's no sense that, like if one looks at Trump's career and where the Republican Party and all the enabling forces of Trumpism, one would have to include the courts, the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation, all the sort of plutocrats in Wall Street and now increasingly in Silicon Valley that want to game the system to keep hold what they can do. And I don't think you can talk about democracy without talking about plutocracy and the power of these corporations. It just does a disservice to analysis, and it just seems like very poor politics. So what I want to say is this podcast takes up the very urgent question of democracy that both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have made the core of their campaign, but actually gives it a grounding in history that really makes us see how big the problem is and how it has to be addressed.
Thank you so much for mentioning that, because it is so important. As I say in a sort of semi-glib way, if you're worried about the democracy crisis, wait till I tell you about the 50-year plot to legalize corruption and end American democracy, right? Let me tell you about 50 years of policies put in place to allow for the buying and selling of elections and legislation and court rulings, right? The democracy, Donald Trump is a symptom, mm-hmm. is an expression of so much of this. And I certainly think he is a threat to what is left of democracy. But I think, Donald Trump is the democracy crisis is really understates what has been going on for the last 50 years. And, I think it's worth ending on the point that this is not inevitable, right? I mean, this is not hopeless.
Yeah.
This is not just, this is what we're not just diagnosing the problem here. There are some solutions to this. I mean, even after Citizens United, even within the Citizens United paradigm, and we have a whole episode that's coming up on Citizens United. But even within that, requiring disclosure of dark money, that's a bill that can be passed. Public financing of elections, that's something that cities and some states have done that can be done. Those are things that have gotten close to passing in Congress before. John McCain, we have a whole episode on him coming up, how John McCain turned the campaign finance reform cause into a national issue and did it pretty quickly. These things can happen. So this is not a hopeless tale. The only way this becomes hopeless is if we accept that this kind of pervasive corruption with Donald Trump running around saying, I'll give the oil industry the policies it wants in exchange for $1 billion of campaign donations. The, Democratic Party donors demanding the firing of the antitrust regulator, Lina Khan, this sort of obvious pay to play culture. There's always going to be some corruption in a political system, but it doesn't have to be at the level that it is right now. And I think what I hope is that Master Plan serves as a reminder that it does not have to be this way. This is not an inevitability. Different decisions can now be made.
Yeah, absolutely. The podcast is actually very good on that. I mean, it's actually a real history podcast in the sense that it doesn't telling a story of Native Lily, but actually emphasizes contingency and agency and contending forces. So yeah, I'll link to the podcast in the show notes. And I want to thank David for being on the program. It's a very fruitful discussion.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.